I'm glad to be here with you guys today. Before we begin, I would love to ask you a question. Have you ever really wanted something, and then when you got it, you found out that that thing that you felt like you wanted was overwhelming or underwhelming or just very, very hard? Finally got your dream job and the learning curve is just bonkers. Or you won an important game and then found out that the pressure to keep winning was even higher. Before this morning's passage, the Israelites had gone through this emotional, crazy victory. The entire nation escaped from slavery, but their liberation did not come without hardship. There were plagues and death and running from an army straight into a miraculously parted sea, only to watch that same sea collapse on their pursuers, drowning a whole army of their oppressors. They were free and they were headed to the promised land. But also, that must have been a lot to process, right? And now they have their freedom, but they are stuck in the in-between. And everything still feels really hard. Back in Egypt, they had been oppressed and abused, but it was a life that they knew. Generations had lived under the system, and even if they didn't like it, they knew how to do it, they knew what to expect. But this weird wilderness life, that was a different story. They are following God, but they don't have a GPS. They don't know when or even if they'll arrive. So it's usually at this point in a story that people start longing for the very thing that they've escaped. Have you heard the phrase, the devil you know? Our brains work on predictive analytics. That's how they keep us safe. So when we step into something unknown, it can feel even more dangerous, even when it's not. Our nervous system starts throwing flags. How will we survive? How will we find our place in community? What will get us booted out of community? When will we arrive at this new goodness, and what if it's not even that good? It's very hard to trust what we can't define. So whenever we move into change, even when that change is a good change, it feels disorienting and dangerous, and that stress puts us into a less trusting, more watchful, more reactive place. Many of us, at least in the short run, would rather keep the devil we know than face the potential danger of the unknown. And if we blindly follow this instinct, it will keep us stuck. And here's the thing. Moving out of something bad into something good is rarely like flipping a switch. Take a moment and just try to think of an example where there would be no hardship in the transition. Maybe getting married, but then you've got the wedding and the family drama and the merging of lives. Or moving into a great new place, but then you are resetting your whole home life. Maybe winning the lottery. But actually, there are multiple studies on happiness of lottery winners, and they will tell you that this huge win rarely produces lasting happiness, and often produces anxiety, paranoia, despondency, and even eventual bankruptcy. So even when something is clearly a very good change worth celebrating, the reality is it's likely to be a little bit bumpy until we find our equilibrium. But often when we are experiencing change, there's some hurt or wounding fueling the transformation. That's because it often takes something hard to push us away from the comfort of knowing into the discomfort of the unknown. And when we're navigating a devastating change, it often feels like it might kill us. Our midweek groups are reading This Here Flesh right now. And the author, Cole Arthur Riley, says that liberation is a process of your soul learning to trust again, that it can rest and love and be still without being destroyed. And then she explains why. She says, when someone has endured bondage for so long and has still found some manner of survival, they may assess the risk of liberation to be greater than the violence of their chains. The clang and the weight of our iron can even become forgettable as our tolerance for it grows. We can write songs to our chains without ever realizing what's making that sound. And this certainly applies to our text for today. So let's talk about this passage that Justine read. Israel is in the wilderness, and they are not enjoying the process. The people spoke against God and against Moses. "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and water, and we detest this miserable food." Then the Lord sent poisonous serpents among the people, and they bit the people, so that many Israelites died. This is the first text in the lectionary for this morning. So I read it, and I read it again, and I was like, dang. Fun fact, I was originally supposed to preach last week, but Wei and Rachel found this great fair on tickets to see family in Australia over spring break, and so we switched, and what I'm saying is Wei did me dirty on this one. Thanks so much for the snakes to, that God sent snakes to kill us in the wilderness verse, Wei. Thank you for that. He is, you know I'm saying that? He's asleep in Australia, probably. But joking aside, this is a very difficult passage. And it's been debated for thousands of years, both by Christian and Jewish theologians. And if you Google it, you will find no shortage of theories. I know this because I have. But I want to pause and acknowledge the elephant in this room. Because here at Vox, we have been talking a lot about the nonviolence of God. And I want to confess to you that there are moments, like in this passage, when I'm not totally sure I can make sense of that. And I think it's valuable to tell you that from sitting up here, because when someone from a pulpit says, "I'm not sure about this," it actually creates the container for people in the whole church to go, "You know, I'm not sure about that either." We do not all have to agree. I'm not trying to pick a fight, but like, this one's hard for me. I can absolutely see Jesus as a practitioner of nonviolence. Peter fought the soldier who was arresting Jesus and then ultimately cut off his ear, and then Jesus just calmly puts it right back on. Little miracle of healing before they perp walk him away. Can't you just imagine Peter in that moment being so dumbfounded? I get it, Jesus, but like maybe there's a time to fight. But then again, we talked last week about that time that Jesus cleared the temple with a whip and then flipped all the tables over. I've heard this story explained a lot of different ways. For example, the text shows that he didn't physically hurt any people. But still, we also talk about nonviolent communication here at Vox. And one of the premises of that is that violence moves beyond just physical violence. And Jesus didn't just lose his cool for a moment. He had a plan in the temple. He took time to fashion a whip before he cleared the temple. Imagine being his disciple in that moment. Jesus, what's going on? What are you making? Is that a whip? And then suddenly their famously non-reactive teacher is creating absolute chaos, driving animals through the space, flipping tables. And as someone who has taught in inner city Chicago and facilitates mediation as part of my job, I can tell you from experience that if someone came in here and started throwing furniture, my nervous system would absolutely react to that as a threat. So if we see this action as perhaps a little bit violent, the next argument you'll hear is, well, he was fighting a system that was a threat to the marginalized. His anger is valid, and he's expressing it on behalf of the poor and the exploited. So this momentary violence is protective and on behalf of liberation. And you know what? I'll allow it. I might even celebrate it. So perhaps this doesn't count as violence, or perhaps we are seeing a stance in which Jesus is saying violence is rarely the answer, but it's not never the answer. I don't know. But there are a lot of stories in the Old Testament that are just hard to square with the idea of a nonviolent God. Stories of decimating cities, instructions for stoning wrongdoers to death, all of the plagues aimed at Egypt to create the space for his people to flee from slavery and into the wilderness where we find ourselves in this very passage. And here in this story, at least on the surface, it sounds like God got a bit fed up with Israel's whining and set snakes to kill them. I mean, as an Enneagram 7, I am not super fond of complaints or commiseration. But this feels a bit reactive. Look, we don't really know everything that was happening here. We've got a few paragraphs to go on, so thank God I am part of a church that has a stated value for mystery. Anyway, I did what any one of us would do when we're faced with the seeming violence of our theoretically nonviolent God. I called Jenna. I said, okay, Vox teacher of all things nonviolent, I'm gonna need you to talk to me about these snakes. And so we did. And the first thing that she brought up is that the snake is not an unknown enemy. We know him from the garden. And when we juxtapose those two stories, we immediately see something interesting. The original lie told in the garden was that God was not trustworthy, that he was withholding something we needed. So let's look back at this verse and see if we can see that same pattern happening here. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we detest this miserable food. Are they seeing God as untrustworthy and withholding? For sure. In fact, first they say that there's no food, and then they say that they hate the food because God has actually already solved their food insecurity with manna, but they are sick of that. We know from neurobiology that when our nervous system feels that we are under too much threat, we are far more likely to misperceive reality, to assume the worst of our enemies, our friends, even God. One minute they're complaining against God, and the next minute they're surrounded by snakes and people are dying, therefore God must be punishing them. If we look through this lens, we can see a possible misunderstanding of God's character here. When we do this, it's called attribution error. Something happens and we attribute it to God, project our own emotions onto him and into our storytelling and our theology. So one way to understand the perceived violence of God in this passage would be to consider that the storytellers here may have misperceived the situation. We are meaning makers. So when something terrible happens, we want there to be a reason. And our storyteller brains will connect the dots, sometimes correctly, sometimes incorrectly. Are we hurting for reasons we don't understand? God must be angry at us. We are being punished. And attribution error has an evil twin, too. Do you want to do something terrible without feeling guilty? God must be angry at them. This violence is holy work. Okay, so I can see it. If we believe there are attribution errors in the Bible, then this story is a prime candidate. But in order to square the idea of a nonviolent God with the dramatic violence of the Old Testament, I think we'd have to make room for a lot of attribution error. And frankly, I'm not sure I'm ready to paint Moses as the unreliable narrator in this story. Plus, it would quickly land us in a new debate about whether the Bible is logically consistent, which parts are literal and which are poetic, and even whether we need to relegate it to the shelf of religious mythology. It's an interpretation, but it fixes one thing by breaking something else, and so I ultimately don't love it. But I do think that attribution errors abound in how we, as human beings, have made sense of the world throughout history. The reality is that sometimes we get it wrong. We can see this in how much division there is among Christians in America around how to live out the scripture. We can look at the same events, read the same scriptures, and assume that God is at work in very different ways. So wherever you land with this passage, it may be helpful to stop and reflect here. Where might you be looking at the snakes and misperceiving God's intent towards you? Now, thankfully, attribution error is not the only lens that we can look through here. So as Jen and I continued to push this back and forth, we had to step back and assess what we mean when we say violence, and therefore, what qualifies as nonviolence. Let's take, for example, a root canal, a battlefield amputation, resetting a bone that has healed incorrectly. Would we call these procedures violent? They involve cutting and causes pain, maybe even trauma. But we don't refer to them as violence because we see them in the bigger picture. The short-term pain is worth the long-term benefit of healing. The problem is, when we are in a painful or scary moment, it's hard to see the big picture. We live more or less in the present moment, and we don't even perceive that perfectly. Paul says, "For now we see in a mirror dimly." But God, who is outside of time, sees with such clarity, and sometimes the bigger picture is more nuanced than the painful moment we're in and the immediate before and after. So let me tell you a story. About 15 years ago, Ben and I both felt that God was leading us to join a team that was planting a new church in Chicagoland. Being part of this new church would mean resigning my current role and moving, but that was easier said than done because we lived in a townhome we'd purchased just a few months before the 2008 real estate burst. So it was now worth drastically less than we paid for it. We prayed and prayed, and we were so clear that God was saying to go. So I met with the pastor, and I told him that for me to join his staff, we would have to short sale our house, but that the bank would not work with us until we were behind on payments. I wanted to know if he was sure he wanted me on his team before we did that. And he asked me to trust him, and I did. We didn't make our next month's mortgage payment, and instead, I took that money and I traveled to a church planting conference with the new team. But a few months later, that same pastor sat me down and shared that he didn't feel at peace about me. What he didn't share at that time was that he had decided to hire his childhood friend for the role that I would have been stepping into. I'd been on his staff at the church he was leaving, but I'd already submitted my resignation, and when I tried to rescind it, they declined because clearly I wasn't committed if I was willing to leave. And since I'd been working as volunteer staff for free, we were also pretty broke. And now we were in a mortgage hole that we weren't sure we could dig out of. And as an added bonus, we had recruited a friend of ours who was living with us to join the team, and he stayed on the team. So that was messy. But by far the most painful wound in this experience was the terror of having gotten it so terribly wrong. If we both heard as clearly as we had ever discerned God's leading that we were to go and now we weren't invited, what would that mean for how we live out our faith moving forward? Do we even hear God? More than a decade later, I still push it back and forth. Did I make a mistake, or did the pastor? Or did God send me on this journey knowing it would knock my teeth out? And if so, why? It's hard to explain how much this broke me in half. It literally felt like it might kill me. Every good thing felt like a lie. I felt like an idiot. And my life, which had such clear purpose yesterday, was fully unmoored. Neither church was safe. And I was so shell-shocked that I couldn't have done my job anyway. So for the past couple of years, I had been working insane hours at this church. And Ben had been traveling during the week to teach IT classes out of state. We only saw each other on weekends. So in those first days, the only thing that I knew is that I needed to be where he was. So I took a leave and I packed up the dog and went with him to Wisconsin for those next couple of weeks. He would leave to teach class all day and I would lay in the hotel bed and stare at the wall. Eventually Ben asked me, "What do you want to do now?" Did I want to stay in ministry? And when I thought about it, I really didn't know. What I did say was, "I just really wanted to have a baby," which honestly surprised us both. Partially because by that point, we were pretty sure that we were not able to have a baby. We'd been married almost 10 years, we'd tried for 6, and we were already talking about adoption. But Ben just said, "Okay, all right." And I remember that night he prayed over me until I fell asleep. And then we sort of forgot about that. Slowly we picked up the pieces, and then just as we started to settle into the new normal, we found out that I was pregnant. And the math made it real clear. I'd conceived Jack in those Wisconsin weeks when it was just the two of us trying to survive the blow. In those weeks, I'd felt betrayed and abandoned by God. And simultaneously, I was ashamed and mortified, like God had tested me somehow and found me lacking. But what I can see now that I couldn't see then is that even in the midst of that devastation, God was creating something beautiful, somewhat beautiful. All these years later, I don't know whether God directed that series of events, or allowed it, or just stepped in to heal it, because sometimes free will means that we hurt each other. But without it, I wouldn't have even been in Wisconsin with Ben to conceive Jack. I would have been working long hours in another state. In 100 other ways, this season shifted our trajectory, and now we live a life that we love, in a city we love, a life we couldn't even have dreamed of 15 years ago. Here's my point. I think it's possible that sometimes God does send something hard our way because of how it will shape us and what it will move us toward, and even what it will move us away from. I think that every once in a while, what feels like violence in the moment ends up being for our benefit in the bigger picture. And if we're honest, pain often shapes us. It builds our empathy and our character. Now, I am not one to say that God directs all of our pain, that everything that happens is God's will. I do think free will and entropy are at play in the events in our lives. But what I do know is that God is endlessly creative and can create beauty in shocking, mysterious ways. And I believe that God sees the whole story when sometimes we can only see the scene that we're in. So assuming that this story from the wilderness is true, then God did in fact send the snakes. But perhaps it wasn't a violent moment of punishment, but an intentional moment of transforming grace in the story of Israel. What if what looks pretty harmful in this short scene served a purpose in the bigger picture? Perhaps God was creating a pattern interrupt, an exigency that would bring them back into right perception. When their trust dwindled and their fear made them begin to misperceive, he uses this scenario to help them lift their gaze. And we know this because of what he does next. The people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned by speaking against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord to take away these serpents from us." So Moses prayed for the people. And the Lord said to Moses, "Make a poisonous serpent and set it on a pole, and everyone who is bitten shall look at it and live." God does not take the snakes away. He says, throw a snake on a pole. People can look at it. The snakes were still biting, but they'll survive. You have to wonder about why God would go about it this way, right? Don't you? Why create the problem only to immediately solve the problem? Perhaps they needed a symbol they'd understand in a new way. You see, this is not the first time that they've had this kind of conversation with God, that they've had this argument about their circumstances. Their complaints to God and Moses are running in a cycle. God's already given them manna to address their fears that they'd starve, but now they're mad about that food, so that was clearly a temporary fix. Their confidence in God erodes, and they begin again to believe the lie from the garden, that God is withholding and untrustworthy. And maybe by putting them into this ongoing situation with the snakes, the enemy from the garden, they have reason over and over again to turn their gaze upward, to trust, to actively work against the lie that is keeping them stuck. And in doing this, they can remember and depend upon a God who knows them and loves them. So let's pause and reflect again. How has God cared for you in times of trouble? And how might turning toward God steady you in these moments? Regardless of how you make sense of the snakes, or even whether you do, we can always lean into mystery. I think we can draw a couple of solid conclusions here. One, change is hard, but focusing on the hardship keeps us stuck, or worse, it makes us return to bondage. And two, when we make a choice to lift our gaze to God, it helps recalibrate our perception, so that rather than living in fear that God is untrustworthy and withholding, we can stand firm in the knowledge that he wants to save us and heal us and make us whole. But we're not quite done with this weird story, because there's a whole other layer baked in here. This lifting of the snake for the purpose of their healing, it's referenced centuries later in the Gospel of John. Chances are you've seen John 3:16 on a bumper sticker. Might be the most memorized verse, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son. But our scene from the wilderness is actually the setup for this oft-memorized verse. If we jump back just two verses, we see the connection here. And just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes in him may have eternal life. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son. At first, when I read this in the lectionary, I was like, these are not the same. God sent the snakes to kill them. He sent Jesus to save them. But one obvious point of similarity is that God is taking something terrifying and making it into a symbol of healing and wellness. In fact, the snake has become a symbol of healing in many world cultures. The snake wrapped around the staff would later become the symbol of Asclepius, or however you would pronounce that, the Greek god of healing, which would inspire the medical symbol we see on ambulances today. If you, like me, have often wondered, why are there snakes on ambulances? Now you know. You're welcome. It's a bit weird, though, how he's shifting our gaze. He's taking our specific fears and turning them into symbols of hope. It's a mystical alchemy of sorts. Something that strips the very fear of its power. God does it with snakes, and he does it again with the cross. I grew up Catholic, but I didn't really see myself as relating to Jesus until late in high school. And when I did, it was a lot. Like, I was so stoked on Jesus that current me would most likely quite dislike college freshman me. I was a WWJD bracelet Christian t-shirt wearing, excitedly tabbing my Bible, wishing I could put a fish on my car, but it was actually my dad's car, and he would have killed me, kind of Christian. In fairness, I was just very excited about Jesus. I was also the girl who dated my first boyfriend in eighth grade for exactly 1 week, but had so thoroughly covered every inch of every notebook with I Heart Andy in that short time that when we broke up, I needed all new notebooks in the aftermath. I'm a little crazy, but I love strong. It's possible I can actually feel your opinion of me sinking in real time. But if you too had an obnoxious for Jesus phase, let's just hold that former version of ourselves with tenderness. We were a bit overexcited. We were in a season of experiencing new life. But more than WWJD bracelets and Christian t-shirts, I really loved crosses. So for my 18th birthday, my mom bought me a gorgeous gold and sapphire cross necklace. And I couldn't wait to show it off to Ben when I got back to campus. And when I did, he said something like, well, I guess the only thing better than wearing a torture device on a necklace is to make it sparkle. Maybe your next necklace can be an electric chair. For those of you who wonder why Ben doesn't say a lot, even though he's clearly not shy, it's because he's learned the hard way that some thoughts are inside thoughts. Never thought about it. I grew up face to face with Jesus still on the crucifix every time we went to Mass. I was frequently chastised by the nuns for wearing my rosary as a necklace. When you grow up inside the church story, the cross is a sign of hope and identity. Plus, I watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and wearing a cross was like Slayer 101. You know you love it. But when Jesus was walking around Israel, the cross was a sign of oppression and humiliation and violence. Crucifixion was a horrific public spectacle, meant to remind the Israelites who was in power and what happens when you don't fall into line. And so God is turning these things that terrify us into a sign of healing and hope, something that we can set our gaze on when we are trembling with fear. And of course, there the story seems to diverge a bit because God did not send Jesus to kill anyone. But if we take a step back, we can see that Jesus did usher in a different kind of death. He walked around brazenly criticizing the religious power structures embedded in Israel. He ushered in change and doubt. He was a very real threat to the temple's authority and the priest's livelihood. Throughout his 3 years of ministry, he crossed paths with the religious elite over and over again, men who anchored much of their identity and self-esteem in being the holy leaders of the community. And every time they interacted with Jesus, he took them down a notch. He eroded their power and pulled people's gaze away from them. It was like he was draining the water from a pool that they were still swimming in. And that put them into a state of stress, which leads to distrust and misperceiving. And he knew that it would. He knew where all of this was headed. The snakes were gathering, and Jesus himself was bitten. The bite came in the form of a kiss, a betrayal from within his own community, and it was a deadly wound. On the cross, Jesus became the scapegoat, something everyone was afraid of being. In the wilderness, God transformed the snake into a symbol of the cure, and in the political turmoil of change, Jesus turned the crucifix into a symbol of resurrection and new life. It's not just death that's nailed to that cross, it's also betrayal and accusation and hatred, and Jesus still chooses love. And somehow all of it is reborn as a symbol of a God who cares for us even in the midst of our woundedness and who will not give up on us even when we have done the wounding. There was something better on the other side of that cross that changed everything it stood for. There was resurrection. There was new life. And while these two stories are about the nation of Israel, the reality is just as true for each of us. When we do the spiritual work of character building or submit to refinement, that often feels like death. Each of us will encounter moments of pain in the midst of our transformation. And when we do, we will have a choice. We can complain or even turn back. Or we can set our gaze on Christ and trust that new life is coming. A couple weeks ago, I was struggling with making a decision where both of the choices felt pretty dicey. And my whole system was activated, running pro-con scenarios and worrying about what ifs to the point that I was not really sleeping. And in the midst of this, I was also writing this homily. I ended up in a conversation with a friend about this decision after spending some time prepping this homily. And mid-sentence, I had this strong sense from God saying, "You are looking at the snakes." And so after I was done feeling silly and kind of pissed at myself, I shifted my gaze. And once I was anchored in God's track record of trustworthiness in our life, the decision became a lot easier. Change and transition and growth always involve stress. And in these moments, we will have to choose to turn back or to stay the course. So let's reflect one more time. How might God want to steady you through a season of change, even now? Now, before we close, I want to name that Vox has been navigating a difficult season of change. While we were already struggling through the pandemic, our founding pastor left our church and the ministry very suddenly, and with almost no warning and no contact afterward. And then before we could even catch our breath, another one of our pastors stepped down. I know that some of you have arrived at VAX after all of this, and you may even wish we would stop referencing it. But for those of us who were here pre-pandemic, the relational violence of these two severing contact felt like a bit of a death. A casual ghosting from two people who had become our friends and teachers and part of our spiritual life. They were connected to how we saw God. Grief is a process that depends on the individual and generally comes in waves. And there are some who have turned back and some who are still in the wilderness, trying to plot a way forward. But know this. God has been planting and nurturing something new here. Out of that devastation came a conversation around doing leadership differently as a shared process. And our community has come alongside our pastoral staff in creative ways to help lift the isolating burden of leadership and even provide funds and space for the kind of care that helps hold burnout at bay. Our pastoral staff has shown up in new ways. And we've brought amazing new staff in who have helped us prepare for the promise of new life and restored joy. When we were surrounded by snakes mid-pandemic, we could have turned back. We easily could have shuttered the doors. A lot of churches did. But there were people here who chose instead to shift their gaze, to trust God in the midst of this struggle, and I am so grateful. And while that season held some very deep wounds for our community as a whole, the fact that we made it through means that this community can support each of us when we face our own set of snakes. Now, it's worth naming that sometimes showing up for community is hard work. It is the wilderness work, especially during times of transition. Coming out of the pandemic, Vox asked the covenant members what they needed most as we returned to gathering. And a very high percentage shared that they were feeling disconnected and needed access to community. And so the staff and navigation team worked together to create opportunities for connection, and they were not widely attended. Justin was here for a one-person workshop one night, so kudos to Justin. I think our muscles for community had atrophied a bit. And even though people wanted connection, when it came time to put on hard pants and attend an event, it felt overwhelming and maybe even scary. In some very real ways, our nervous systems weren't quite ready for that change, even though it was a change that we were longing for. And for some of us, that has kept us stuck. As Vox heads into this new season, I want us to be thinking about whether we are willing to stay in the hard task of showing up for community and moving forward toward the promise of experiencing the joy of community, even if, and maybe especially if, it means trusting God after we've been bitten. In fact, I believe community is part of God's plan to help us each survive our own pathways through the wilderness. I know this because this community has been so instrumental in my healing. So as God continues to weave the fabric of connection here at Vox, I want to close with a benediction from Sarah Bessie from her book, Miracles and Other Reasonable Things. She says, "I pray that you would stay open to the ways that God is transforming us. May you be given the gift of the gate and the shepherd, the wilderness and the pasture. And when you are in that place, I pray that like Mary Magdalene did, you will hear Jesus say your name at the moment of your deepest despair, the moment when you believe God is dead and everything is over. Because then you will lift your head and you will rise in hope." Amen.